Welcome to the MHI Cast, the show where we talk to the industry's best minds to uncover their supply chain stories. We explore real-world case studies and get unique perspectives on key trends and emerging technologies from every corner of the material handling, logistics, and supply chain space. Welcome to a special MHI podcast talking all about racking and automation live at ProMat 2025. Now, this is the show where we talk to the industry's best minds to uncover real-world case studies and the unique perspectives on key trends and emerging technologies. Today, I'm talking with Christopher Aprile, Senior Structural Engineer at Steel King Industries, Carlos Oliver, President of Fraser, and Bill Edgy, National Sales Director at Atoma, about everything we need to know about racking and automation in warehouse operations. Thank you all for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Chris, I'm going to start with you. I'd like for you to give us an overview of traditional racking and pallet systems and their primary functions in warehouse operations. We'll kind of start with the baseline.
Okay, great. Traditional racking that's been around for probably 50, 60 years, I would say, is the backbone of the industry. I mean, we're talking about stuff that, you know, pallet, normal GMA pallets, and it's called basically static or gravity rack. You have an aisle where a forklift can go down and basically set a pallet down on a rack, a shelf, and it's comprised of basically uprights and beams. You can get that in either roll form, cold form steel, or structural hot rolled steel. So it's what every OEM of racking does as their bread and butter. I would say it's probably 90% of what they sell.
And of course, over time, we see changing demands in logistics and warehousing. And so how have you seen warehouse storage systems evolve?
Oh, that's a good one. You know, over the years, obviously with the advent of more complex robots and automation, you know, over the years, automation is getting better and better with the technology. Just like anything else with your home computer, you've got better computers that run, you know, robots and automation shuttles. You're able to basically make your system as a whole today safer as a whole because of automation. You've got a lot less risk to, you know, the everyday warehouse employee.
Carlos, I want to have you jump in here too. What are some of the key differences between those conventional pallet racking systems and what we're seeing now that's more designed for automation?
The key differences are tolerances. The ability of designing and manufacturing and installing a rack system that can work with an automated system. A conventional system has a lift truck operator. He engages the pallet, picks it up, puts it in an opening, and he's doing everything visually. So if the rack is off a little bit, out of tolerance, out of plumb, it doesn't really much matter. But in a highly integrated system, a computer sensors on the lift truck and or the crane is going to take your pallet and bring it to a location, and it better be where it goes because there's no going back at that point. So sometimes you can hit a rack, you can hit a beam, and you get into trouble that way. So it's got to be perfectly aligned, and the manufacturing process for that type of rack is a lot different than conventional rack.
Would you add to that, Chris?
I would say that's absolutely. We in America have standards for tolerancing for rack. Unfortunately, I would say that the Europeans have a better tolerance system. It's actually called FEM, and we have to, a lot of times, adhere to be competitive with the European product. We have to be as competitive with their tolerancing. So FEM is their tolerancing system, and you know, we're talking about maybe a 30, 40 foot rack up in the air, you know, only deflecting, you know, 10 millimeters or less. I mean, you can imagine the type of tolerancing that you have to hold.
So if we want a successful storage rack system design, what are the building blocks that we need to start with then?
So the building blocks, you know, if you're talking about just laying it out with the customer, you want basically the loads, maximum and average loads. You know, we go off maximum now because it's the easiest, you know, you're going to be conservative and designed to the maximum load. Obviously, people aren't going to load their rack to the maximum condition. And as a structural engineer, obviously I like that, especially in high seismic designs. But, you know, the loads, what they want as far as bay widths, you know, if they're going to put a tunnel or have a forklift go in the middle of their warehouse, they want a tunnel so they don't have to have the forklift truck go all the way down to the end of the aisle, which could be hundreds of feet long, you know, so they want to be able to access the middle of their racking. So you have to get that planned out. It's really about working with the customer and seeing what their low capacities are going to be, what they're going to be loading. You know, are they going to bring a truck in and unload it all at once onto one system, which would typically be like a drive-in system or something that's really dense. So there's, you know, we work with the customer. It's not just we want rack, you know, because there's so many different systems that all the OEMs, we have a little bit of flavor for everybody.
Yeah, keep telling us about that for a second, because you were talking about kind of load in different pieces. I want to know, does material selection and structural integrity, are they things you're thinking about that are impacting the long-term success of the systems?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it goes back to safety and, you know, the less automation and the less robotic and you know, the more manual forklifts, the more robust you want your system. So you want that to be hot rolled steel generally. I mean, Coform is, you know, in most cases, a cheaper alternative, and it can be strong, but you know, you can damage it. So you have to do, you have to get all the auxiliary stuff to protect your rack, like say column protectors, row end protectors. These are all additional costs to the customer because you're using, you know, a thinner gauged Coform steel.
So there's quite a few different things to consider. Carlos, I want to bring you into this too. When we're talking about things like rack alignment and even, we haven't mentioned this yet, but floor flatness and things like that, what's your recommendation? How do these things fall in line of priorities?
Well, when you're starting off from the beginning, is determining which direction you're going to go and having the knowledge base to be able to build a system to that effect. Floor flatness is extremely important, and there's various deviations of floors that you could have depending on the lift truck you're using. And in a case of automation, you're shimming everything to a datum point. So everything works off the same plane so that when the lift goes up, puts a pallet in, it's exactly where it's supposed to fit. So yes, the floor flatness is absolutely very important, and how you design the rack for that. It's very difficult to do that after the fact. Converting an existing rack system to an automated system is a big challenge, because a lot of times it just doesn't work without reconstructing, bringing it down, reshimming it, reinstalling it. And sometimes the way it was built 10 years ago doesn't work for what they need now, according, like Chris was saying, the FEM code just won't meet it.
It sounds like there are some tough challenges to get by here. So if someone's listening and they're thinking this is a bit daunting, but they do want to upgrade to more automation, I think probably a lot of you could jump in here on where do they start? What do they do to overcome some of those challenges? And if we haven't mentioned a new challenge yet, feel free to add that in.
Bill, maybe you want to take that, because yeah, on the level of people that are looking to automate, what are the different benchmarks that they have in order to determine whether they should automate or not?
There are a number of criteria where that's concerned. One of the biggest is to depend on your structural engineer, like Chris, and the integrator that you're using to implement this automation system to gather the right information. Some of the most commonly overlooked things are things like floor flatness, which we touched on, and planning. Listen, there are a number of ways to get into automation. And when you're planning this, you really need to know what your end goal is. If, for instance, if AGVs are going to be implemented into an automation system, you need to be aware of that. You need to plan for that. So there's a number of considerations that your lift truck or rack automation professional is going to take in consideration when gathering and planning a system for you.
And then just to add to that real quick, is that the fork in the road to determine whether you go conventional or automation wholeheartedly depends on a number of different issues. One is price of labor, price of land, and product mix, and determine and volume coming in and volume going out. If I'm only moving 2 pallets an hour into the facility, there's no way you're going to justify automation or the expense in it. You got to take people off, justify by taking people off equipment, the square footage of the land you're building it on is real expensive. You don't have any height restrictions, so you can go 130 foot tall, and your labor is real expensive on top of all that. So those are the primary reasons that people go to automation and why it's more and more every year it's happening.
So how are you thinking about future-proofing with all of those kind of things to think about? Future-proofing.
Future-proofing. So that's an interesting comment. I haven't heard that word before. I like it. Can I write it down?
Yeah, by all means.
Future-proofing.
Yeah.
Well, when you future-proof, means that you better build whatever you're building today so that it works later for that.
Exactly.
So we all want to know that down the road, they're going to potentially put automated equipment in so that we built the racking in case that ever happens. You could blow this thing through the roof if you don't do that. It won't ever work down the future. And the problem is a lot of people buy the system because, namely, the tolerance for example, a rack beam deflection in the RMI is L over 180, which is the distance divided by 180 inches. In a typical 8-foot sections, that's a good half an inch. Well, in an automated system, a half inch will never work. It usually needs to be a quarter of an inch. So right out of the get-go, that could blow your system up if you ever try to automate down the future.
I think you just touched on one important thing that is something that people might overlook. Are there other things that are commonly overlooked when making these decisions?
Absolutely. Little things like power supply, Wi-Fi capacity in a building, the system that you're planning, the ease of maintenance with regard to future upkeep of the system, rack capacity, rack structure capacity, seismic concerns. All of these are things that the common end user doesn't necessarily think about and would depend on a material handling specialist to gather the right information about it.
And also on top of that, you get fire protection, water supply, gallons per minute, to be able to increase the density of the storage in case you need to do that. The higher you go, the more water and the more pressure you need.
Especially in North America, we are nowhere near where Europe is with regard to automation. Many years ago, they ran out of land over there, and the only way to automate was to go up. In North America, we've got plenty of greenfield, plenty of even brownfield that we can go in, and rather than go up, we go out. But they're paying for that space above. Why not utilize it? And that's the only way to do that is through automation.
So based on that, are we seeing some really interesting pallet racking and design system trends or new designs that are coming into play for shelving systems?
Well, for racking systems?
Yeah, for racking and shelving. Are we seeing new designs?
Shelving's a different product sector. That was yesterday. Yes, there's the innovation seem to be more located towards pallet handling, density in pallet handling, and increasing throughput and movements. The other issue is that the thing that's always been the most difficult to automate or justify is case handling. Typically in a warehouse, a pallet, you have a pallet of a specific item and you want to take 10 cases off it. A guy would take 10 cases on a pallet jack, put them down. Well, when you think about it, the cost of doing that is one man or lady with a pallet jack, which is a $5,000 piece of equipment, and stack cases and off you go. The only issue you got with predominantly there is workman's comp. And they're paid on incentive, how many pieces per hour they can pick. So that's always been the hardest one. You now have a lot of movement in that area where people are starting to automate the case handling technology and making things faster, brisker, and also looking at the competitive wage scale. As people get paid more, the more it's easier to justify an automated type approach.
I'd like to touch on, Bill mentioned, you have to do things with the mindset of scalability. I mean, when you plan things out, like say 10 years from now, a warehouse that was built with a 40, 50, 60 foot tall rack, you want to add to it, you can add to it, but if you don't plan for those designs, you almost have to design ahead of time and ask the customer, do you think you're ever going to go up higher? Obviously, that's the reason why you would do automation, is to build up higher as opposed to necessarily taking up a big square footage of, but you have, sometimes you have a 20,000 foot warehouse with a 40 year old rack. And like Carlos said, sometimes actually people take down that rack and move it to another location where they don't need the automation. And they replaced that whole warehouse with automation. So it's a big, obviously a big capital investment. You don't want to go into it with, you know, blinders thinking that, you know, you have to. That's the thing about with his company, Fraser, and my company, Steel King, and Bill's company. We're RMI aficionados, so to speak. I mean, we are in tune with the codes. We are in tune with the specifications overall across the industry. We know what works and what doesn't. You don't want to get with someone that doesn't know. If you're spending millions of dollars, you want to get with the experts, you know, so it's not something to take lightly.
That makes sense. And so, touching on some of the other pieces that might influence you, how racking systems are built, how do ASRS play into this?
Well, as we mentioned before, is the amount of automation and also the design of the rack to work with that. Higher tolerances, you have to be more careful on how you punch the columns so that you don't get a lot of growth in the columns. The welding is or bolt together is done in a form where, once again, you're keeping tight tolerances and also the installation of it. A lot more care is being done so that the rack is not leaning one direction or another too much to make it be difficult for the crane or the shuttle to go into the rack system.
Mm-hmm. Oh, keeping on that thought, let's go into AGVs. How are they impacting that?
Oh, interesting. AGVs, the same thing. The AGVs, you now have a manless vehicle running through this warehouse, and when they get to a rack opening, it needs to be where that opening, where it thinks it is. So you got a couple things playing against you. You have the floor slab moving up and down. You have the rack system moving up and down, and now this AGV has to come in and insert the mass of the lift truck and the pallet through a set of rails if it's going into a driving system, or onto a stack of carts if it's a pushback system. So yeah, once again, that needs to be at a higher tolerance than the stuff we've been building for 30 years.
Bill, would you add to that? What are you seeing with AGVs?
I think one of the biggest keys to the implementation of AGVs is the design of the warehouse. You need to design the warehouse such that the AGV does not experience any obstructions, which are going to cut down on throughput rates. And maintaining throughput rates is the key to a successful AGV implementation.
It seems there are a lot of different things to consider here. Does anyone have, maybe Carlos, do you have a real world example of someone implementing this changeover from more traditional to automated ready systems?
Oh my goodness, I've been doing this I just found out today, somebody came up to me and said, hey, congratulations, 43 years.
So you might have, like, you might have an
what?
Example or two in your time.
What are you talking about? Is it time to retire? 43 years, I said, holy crap. So for 43 years, I've seen a lot. And you've seen smaller companies, you've seen Walmart growth. You've seen Amazon was 15 years ago, it didn't exist. Now there's this juggernaut out there. So a lot of these companies just started out with good old generic pallet racking, and then they went to deep reach racking, and then maybe they went from reach trucks, they went from counterbalance, which is a sit-down truck that may go up maybe 20 feet, to reach trucks that may go up to 30 feet. Then they went to turret trucks that go up to 40 feet. And then all of a sudden, years later, they're building an ASRS going 130 feet. We just did a system for Dollar Tree. Dollar Tree was nowhere to be found 20 years ago. And we built a 250,000 position facility in Florida that's completely automated. There's nobody in it. It's absolutely incredible. And to fill all their stores that are selling a product for little or not money. And guess what? Guess what their justification was? They can't get labor. So when you can't get labor, if I can't get 300 people on two shifts to run a lift truck, what do I do? All of a sudden, the expense of the system pales in comparison to not being able to run a facility.
These places that he's referred to, I don't know necessarily about his Dollar Tree his project there, but it could be a blackout facility. A blackout facility or light out facility is one that doesn't use lights. Why would you need light? Robots don't need lights, you know, so, and you don't need to adjust the air conditioning to be a perfect room temperature for robots. So that's kind of the benefit. Of course, the robots have to be maintained. You have to have a higher skill level of person to do that type of programming or robots. So, you know, there's a trade-off there.
Let's stay on that topic of kind of the workforce a little bit, and I want to go to you, Bill. What does automation impact in terms of warehouse workforce requirements overarchingly? What are you seeing?
Well, we've all heard this as automation specialists. If I implement automation, I'm going to lose my job. I can honestly say that I've never sold an automated system to put anybody out of a job. What the automated systems do is allow the company to operate with higher efficiency, which allows the company to repurpose those employees into more value-added positions that potentially even pay more money, such as maintain these automation systems. These are mechanical systems that have to be maintained by someone. So there are a lot of impacts, good, and there are some perceived bad. As far as job loss, attrition is going to eat up some of that. But again, most companies that are going to operate more efficiently are going to be able to afford higher wages to pay for repurposed employees.
And by the way, most of these facilities are greenfield. There's no employees to start with. So one of the reasons they're deploying this technology is because, like I said before, they needed 600 people if they're going to use lift trucks, but there's none in that market. So it's not like anybody lost a job. There were no jobs to begin with. So the greenfields are usually what we see more of rather than a conversion to a brownfield, from a brownfield.
Yeah, we need to look at kind of the consumerism trends that are going up at the same time, right? Bill, would you add to what you said before in terms of kind of what are the skills that are really needed to maintain those systems? Will you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so factory trained service technicians, IT people to handle the software related to the automated systems, that type of professional.
If we're thinking about kind of wrapping this all into some advice for people that are tuning in, what advice would you give to companies looking to integrate automation, but maybe they're hesitant because these concerns that are coming up with their company about workforce, or maybe just investment costs they're worried about for automation? What would be that kind of main advice that we would give?
I think we were talking about that before,
is that
baby steps. You don't go from zero to 100 in a VW, right? You start with small steps in automation and work your way up to get comfortable with each step until you can get to the largest step. Especially if you don't have the staff or resources in place that can manage this effort, because it's pretty daunting, like you were saying before, to go from lift trucks to a heavily automation. So there's steps in between that you can take to get you there.
I completely agree with Carlos. Scalability, we've said it several times during this discussion today. You design a system to scale to a larger automation trend for your company. Ease into it, as Carlos said, baby steps. Semi-automation is a good way to step into automation to find out if your company has an appetite for it.
Any final thoughts, Chris?
Oh, I agree. I mean, you have to be, again, when you sit down with your customer and you know they're looking for you as the expert, and you don't want to just say, I'll sell you a $50 million automation. There's smaller scale projects that they can have, semi-automated, type pallet runners or what have you, that are in existing drive-ins or converted into existing drive-ins. And so, you know, you get the benefit of maybe spending under $1 million, but it's a lot safer. You're reducing a lot of, you know, possible injuries. That's the thing we hadn't really talked about, is it reduces the number of injuries in the shop or in the warehouse, and it makes life a lot better for your employees.
Not to mention potential product damage.
Product damage, yes.
And I'll say one more thing, is that do your homework. Do the research on the companies that you think you want to do work with. Get references. Get proven facilities and proven sites. Where are they buying the equipment from? There's a lot going on around right now with products coming in from all over the planet. Be careful where it's coming from, and make sure that they could deliver and install the project, because there's a lot of projects that never get completed on time because they try to save an extra dollar and go places where they shouldn't go. So do your homework. Make sure the people that you're working with are viable, honest, loyal, and trustworthy.
And we've got some great examples of U.S. companies right here on this panel, so you can find more advice from them afterwards. We'll make sure you know how to reach them all. But again, thank you so much, Christopher, Carlos, and Bill, for being with us here today and having this discussion. And that was our special episode of our podcast here live at ProMat 2025. At MHI, we never stop exploring new opportunities to help take you and your business and manufacturing and supply chain operations all to the next level. So thank you for making us part of your professional development journey.